Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hi, folks. I'm really glad to be talking again to my wonderful audience, leaders in the field, pioneers, cutting-edge folks around the world, and especially in North America and Great Britain. Delighted to be in touch with all of you on this weekly basis. My guest today, Pam Popper. Pam, are you there?
Sure.
Hi. Pam has been on this show in the past, most recently in July, which enables me to remind you that you can now go to my website, bregan.com, and up at the top where it talks about selected accomplishments or something like that, you can punch the radio, and you can actually search then the many years of radio I've been doing by subject and by the name of a person. So if you wonder if Pam's been on before, you can, and or you want to hear her, you could just go put in Popper or Pam, and you will get to her show right away. And this is something that is right on our version of the archives. The show is archived, and it's on our version of the archives that on the website that you can get this great stuff. And I also want to remind you that it is a new website. It's much easier to negotiate. The search mechanism works much better. And I've put on it a brand new, huge section, the Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center, the Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center, which has an enormous amount of information about this dread disease caused mostly by the antipsychotic drugs. It causes a terrible abnormal movements, but also harms the mind, the brain and the mind. And whether you're a patient or a family member or a prescriber or a researcher, you can go right there and find at your fingertips available in PDF form the most important and readily available, and I'm making them readily available, scientific papers. So this is a big deal. I hope even that medical experts other than myself will learn enough off of the Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center to be able to participate effectively as medical experts. No, I'm not afraid of the competition. I'm afraid that there won't be enough folks, and there aren't enough even now doing some of this important work. Now, with Pam here, y'all can hear me speak this weekend because I'm going to go and talk at a conference being put on by Pam. I'll let her tell you more about the conference, but it's in Ohio. It's in Columbus, Ohio, and I'm going to be speaking on Saturday, November 5th. Last I heard, that day I'll be talking about psychiatric medications. And then on the following Saturday, November 6th, I'm going to be talking about empathic therapy and better alternatives. Is that the order of things still, Pam?
That is the order of things. You're the only person making two presentations.
So you're, well, that's great.
You're the guest of honor.
Thank you. Well, I'm really glad to be there. And Pam, I want to just hand the mic over to you for a bit to talk about your conference. But let me say just a few more words about you. You're such a dear friend that I just assume everybody knows about Pam Popper. Pam is a naturopath. She's a nutritionist. And she's executive director of the Wellness Forum. And this is a forum that offers educational programs to individuals to help with their health. And they involve diet or nutrition and lifestyle. But it's also there to help employers in reducing the cost of health care. She works with employers. So she's actually got a number of different ways that she approaches better health and also reversing illness. And one of them is through courses she gives at her own college. I will have her tell you about that. and through these programs she does with healthcare providers. She's an extraordinarily active, intelligent, forthright, reform-minded, courageous human being whom I admire much. And she's also on the Physician Steering Committee. I might like to hear more about that for Physicians for Responsible Medicine in Washington, D.C. She's done feature films, books. She's a wonder. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Thank you so much for all of that. And right
it's
back
all true.
At you.
It's all true.
I was preparing my comments for when I'm going to introduce you for your first talk on Saturday, and I figured out that if I really told everybody everything that you've done, we'd have to add an extra day onto the conference. We'd spend all day Saturday. We'd just talk about all the things you've done. Then you could speak on Sunday and then on Monday, too. So, yeah, both of us have had a very busy life, right?
Yes. And yours parallels mine much more than most people, because you have really been active in standing up on against government committees in your state and other places around some of these issues.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been very, very strong.
Well, you have to do it. And you know, you and I are both, we're fighting the same battle, just a little bit different subject matter. But, you know, our practice specialty here is informed medical decision making. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we're both saying is that if consumers knew the risks associated with a lot of the things that they're told to do and how small the chance of benefit really is, we would be spending $500 million a year on healthcare in this country instead of $3 trillion, because we know informed decision-making drives up the demand for a lot of the stuff that we're ranting and raving about. So I'm very adamant, and it's been a great, you know, you and I have both paid the price personally for some of the stands that we've taken, but I think it's important to do, and we have the luxury of doing it to a certain extent, not that it makes it any less frightening when the government comes after you, but the difference between you and I and some of the others is that we're not working in institutions. We're not worried about losing our jobs. And so I feel that because I have that advantage, I should take advantage of it and be more outspoken, which I've done. So I'd like to think that the fighting with the government part is a little bit in my past, but I don't rule it out in the future just because there's so much money in the healthcare field. And when you start threatening people's economic well-being, as you know, they get a little antsy about it. They get a little vicious sometimes. So anyway.
Absolutely. By the way, you sound really clear. Are you on just a cell or are you on a hard line?
I'm on a hard line. I managed to make it back to the office.
You sound really clear.
Yeah, it's better if we do these on a landline. I try to whenever I can. So anyway, I'm excited you're coming this weekend because really this is the best in the world of informed decision-making speakers who talk about mental health and musculoskeletal health and biological illness. And this is the forum for ideas on how to help people get well. You know, healthcare doesn't really help people get well. It's, in fact, the medical model only works if you keep people sick, because if they get well, they don't need you anymore. And then there's no money in that. So we're sort of the outliers there. But we've been doing this for 20 years. This is our 20th anniversary. So this conference is exciting to me because, first, you're coming to speak as one of our partners. Second of all, it's a big celebration. For us, I think 20 years in business is a big deal. I mean, I never thought about that when I started, and I think it's a big accomplishment. And then the roster of speakers, you know, even in addition to you, is pretty impressive. So we're going to have a very impressive conference, a great time for everybody. I think the speakers are all interested in hearing about each other. I know Dr. Seyfried and Dr. Campbell can't wait to meet you. And, you know, so lots of interaction and ideas flowing, not just from the speakers to the audience, but amongst everybody there. So I'm really looking forward to this. It's always a fun weekend.
Tell, and I'm going to celebrate 62 years since I first stepped into a mental hospital as a college volunteer in 1954.
Wow.
Okay.
And don't
go,
you wonder
if
where
I go
the
back
time
20
went
years, I'm in the middle of everything.
Yeah.
Tell the folks first how they learn about the conference and sign up for it, and then take us through when it begins and, you know, tell us a little bit more about the other speakers in addition to me.
Yeah, I'll do that. So first of all, our website is wellnessforumhealth.com, wellnessforumhealth.com. So you go to that website, and you'll see it's right there. You can't miss it, Conference 2016. There's even a little video of me talking about the conference and why you should come. It starts on Friday evening at 6, and it runs through Sunday at noon. And I'll tell you about some of the speakers. You know, you mentioned Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And Dr. Neil Barnard is the founder of that organization in Washington. He'll be the opening speaker on Friday night. He was a psychiatry. His medical specialty was psychiatry, although he never practiced, which I think is interesting. And boy, he's been a mover and shaker in reforming healthcare. One of the big accomplishments of PCRM has been eliminating the use of animals in medical training. I mean, seriously, I always tell people this. If you have a child who's choking and you need me to intubate the child, do you want me to have practiced on kittens or something that looks like your six-year-old, you know? And so this is a very important issue. Not only is it cruel to animals, and we always complain a little bit about lack of compassion in medicine. We certainly don't build compassionate doctors when we have them abusing dogs all day and killing them at the end of the day, but it's better medical training. And 100% of all medical schools in the United States have given up that practice now, and PCRM got that done. The other thing that PCRM has been very active in doing is conducting medical research on diet and migraines, diet and rheumatoid arthritis, diet and type 2 diabetes. They've done a lot of work on the Native American reservations, helping that population, which is genetically predisposed to develop diabetes, rampant in the Native American population, showing that about 100% of the time within a few weeks, the diabetes goes away with the right diet. So you can imagine what it means to those people. So anyway, he is the opening speaker on Friday night, and he always has interesting things to say. He has a new book coming out next year on cheese, and that's what he's going to be talking about, cheese.
Now, he starts at 6 p.m.?
Yeah, the dinner starts at, I think there's a little bit of a meet and greet, and then we all sit down at about 6:30, and Neil will speak at about 7:15, and then he'll sign books afterwards. He has a great book out called Power Foods for the Brain, and it's an excellent book on the relationship between diet and Alzheimer's disease and that sort of thing. So he'll speak, and then he'll autograph books, and then we're going to do a screening for people who haven't seen it of Food Choices, the new film I'm in. So everybody can stick around. We'll make some popcorn, and you know that can be the late night entertainment. Some people will probably go to
Pam,
bed.
Pam, I'm going
to
be there. I don't know if you realize that, but I get in early enough so that I can make the dinner. Will you save me a seat?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And then I can meet the doc. I think it's going to be very interesting. I want to learn about cheese. I love cheese, and I was told by a nutritionist to think of it as nothing more than fat and salt.
Well,
which kind of spoiled my appetite.
Hormones, estrogen, insulin-like growth factor. If you want to grow some cancer, there's just nothing better to eat than cheese.
I want to learn about these things, so I'm going to come.
Yes, and Neil's very interested in meeting you, obviously. When he saw your name, he knew who you were when he saw your name on the roster of speakers. So he's anxious
to
meet you. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the Friday night program. Then we're going to screen the movie. And by the way, Food Choices hits Netflix today, so now you can watch it on Netflix, which is wonderful, in 190 countries and translated into 25 languages. So very excited about that. Our phone's ringing off the wall. It's a great movie, not because I'm in it, but because the filmmaker is just extraordinary. And he's going to be there, too, by the way, the guy who produced the film. And then on Saturday, you're speaking, and then Dr. Janice Stanger is speaking. She's a personal friend and colleague of mine.
What time do I speak?
You speak first thing on Saturday. So
morning, I didn't agree to that, but I guess I'm doing it.
We don't start
what time
early.
In the morning?
It's 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock.
Oh, my God. Okay, I'll do it.
We'll make sure we tuck you in early on Friday night.
Yes.
But, so 9 o'clock in the morning we start, and you're up first for your first talk. And then my colleague, good friend, and teacher for the Institute, she's a content creator for Wellness Forum Health. She also is an amazing author herself. She wrote a good book called The Perfect Formula Diet. And Dr. Janice Fanger is the next person. And she's speaking on the topic of nutrition and pregnancy, how to have a healthy pregnancy. And that is just as misunderstood as the psychiatric drug business. And one of the things I love about Dr. Fanger, and why she speaks at all of our conferences, is that she is terrific at taking complicated information and making it understandable to anybody. And every time I listen to her speak, I learn something new, sometimes not necessarily a fact I didn't know, but a way to explain it that helps my patients to understand it better. And so I've learned so much from her over the years. She's one of our favorite instructors here. So Dr. Fanger comes up next, and then after lunch, Dr. Tom Seyfried speaks, and he is the author of a medical textbook called Cancer as a Metabolic Disease. It's a page-turner for somebody like me. It's about Dr. Seyfried's hypothesis in his book. He's a geneticist who says that genetics do not cause cancer. That's not the main cause of cancer. In fact, genetic mutations in the cells take place after the cell turns cancerous. And his book is about how to turn cancer into a chronic condition that people could die with but not of. And I think that's a fascinating area to discuss. And so I use his book in the classes that I teach through the Institute. So that's the Saturday program, and the last speaker on Saturday is Dr. Colin Campbell, the author of The China Study and WHOLE, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition. And he'll be talking about why isn't nutrition a medical specialty? I think that's an interesting question to explore, too. So that's the Saturday program. And then you're back up on Sunday, and also Dr. Marielle.
Is there a Saturday evening part to it?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a Saturday evening part. That's the fun part. So we all leave the room, and they set up the ballroom for a 20th anniversary celebration, which starts at 6 o'clock with cocktails and hors d'oeuvres, and 7 o'clock, a four-course sit-down dinner, and we give out awards, and we have graduation for our school, and we have fun. There's some fun inserted in there, and then we have a DJ and dancing and cocktails and cupcakes and champagne toast. And so that's fun. We're going to celebrate Saturday night, and it's going to be a fabulous party. So I don't know that anybody will learn anything other than how much fun we are to hang out with. We're not all science nerds. So that's what everybody will learn on Saturday night. And the food is extraordinary. We have taught this hotel how to make extraordinary food that is exactly right for our group. And they're really good at it. It's healthy food that is delicious, and everything's been taste tested before we get there and all that sort of thing. So that's what we're doing Saturday night. And then Sunday morning you get to talk again. And
9 a.m.
again? No, the first speaker is going to be Marielle Von Lanthen. She's a gastroenterologist, a colleague of mine from Little Rock, Arkansas, and her talk is going to be on resolving reflux with diet. She's a fascinating woman. She was educated. She went to medical school in Belgium and then came here to the United States. She's a great advocate. She started breastfeeding programs in San Antonio and other places. And I've always said that if I had a problem, I would want Marielle or somebody like her to take care of me. She's one of the best physicians I know in the entire country. So that's the lineup. And so you can see we have a variety of topics. We have a variety of different doctors with different expertise. And the consumers will learn a lot, but about a third of this conference is health professionals, and they also will learn a lot. And one of the most encouraging things I've found, and I think you have found this too in your work, is the number of doctors and nurses and dietitians who are saying, just like I had to say at one point in time, I think my training may not have been right, and I need to learn some new things, and I'm willing to do that, and I have an open mind, and I will change the things that I'm doing if you show me what works better. And so a third of our audience is going to be health professionals who are coming here for that purpose.
Yeah, so, I was just actually thinking that I hope that just a whole variety of health professionals, maybe, I know this is at the last minute, although I've talked about this conference before on the air, but this is getting last minute now, but I just hope health professionals around the country will say, hey, I'm going to go. I'm going to go. This could change my life. Now, well, when do I speak on Sunday?
You speak on Sunday. I don't have the agenda in front of me, but I want to say it's something like 10:30, something of that nature, in that vicinity. And by the way, a psychiatrist, a local psychiatrist, has been coming, who is a member of our center here, and she's coming to the conference with her husband. And you and I and she are having dinner on Sunday night. She's very anxious to meet you, and she's read a lot about you, read a lot of your books, and she's one of those people who's shown up here saying, gosh, maybe some of the things I learned weren't right. I'm ready to learn some new things. I'm here with an open mind. Show me how to do better. You know, so love that, right?
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. You just have such a huge influence. It's growing and growing.
Well, We hope it continues to grow and grow. I've made no secret of what my plan is here. I think that healthcare is ripe for disruption, and I think that how it's going to happen is consumers finding out. This is a consumer revolution because the medical profession and all the tentacles of it, drug companies, et cetera, there's just so much money in this thing right now that it cannot fix itself from within. I mean, seriously, think about some medical institution that says, you know what? For a few $100, we can teach people to eat so they don't need to have bypass surgery. So we'll just lop off $100 million of our revenue every year and do that. I mean, it's never going to happen. It's a pipe dream. So this has to come from practitioners waking up and doing things differently and consumers waking up en masse and essentially creating a revolution of people who just flee the existing system, and we want to be the place that they go. And I think that the system is so precarious right now that it's possible to make a real dent in their market. And so people think I'm dreaming, but I tell people, if you look at our track record, you might not want to discount what I'm saying so quickly, because we've accomplished a lot. I mean, we've changed laws in a lot of states. We do business in 35 countries. We've developed a school of our own and a training program. So you start adding all this stuff up, and I'll tell you, I wouldn't bet against us. We just might get that done. So I'm excited. I wake up every day excited, and that's why I want everybody to take care of themselves. I'm going to live to 100 because I need a few more decades to get this done. So I need other people to live to 100 too. So let's all eat well, take care of ourselves, and keep fighting the good fight. That's what I want to promote.
Wow. Well, listen, folks, I really hope that some of you, maybe hordes of you, will come to the conference and come up to me and tap me on the shoulder and say, I came because I heard Pam on your radio show. That would just make me a really happy guy, just to have some of you do that. Come up and just tap me and say, hey, I heard Pam on the radio show. I'm so glad to be here. So glad to meet you. Pam, tell folks more about this training program, the people in all these many different countries around the world, and also so fascinating how you set up a college of your own.
Yeah, well, I'll start with the training programs. When we started in this field, and I always use the collective we because I think it would be incredibly disingenuous for me to give anybody the impression that I did any of this by myself. I mean, you've met some of my people, and they're amazing people, and the group of us together, you know, many hands make light work, so this is a group effort here. And when we started all this with the idea that, my gosh, things have to change, you recognize at some point in time, at least we did, that I'm only one person, one practitioner, and this is only one company, one group of people. We have got to train health professionals. And at about the time that we realized this, that this was so systemic that we had to approach it from healthcare training standpoint, that was when professionals were starting to really wake up. I was going to conferences and meeting people who were saying, I need to learn some new things. So anyway, that's what drove us to set up our school. And we started with a couple of programs when we first started the school. One was one is a certificate program for health professionals, and doctors get 39 CMEs for it, dietitians, nurses. It's continuing education, and it's an overview course that teaches people how to practice the way that I do, following the evidence, minimal medication, showing people how to have informed discussions with patients, and that kind of thing. And we have put hundreds of people through that program, and they're everywhere. They're in Serbia. They're in Norway. They're in Australia. They're in New Zealand. In fact, I cannot remember the last time we offered that course, and we do it 3 times a year, when we didn't have at least a couple of foreign students enrolled, which is pretty amazing. And so that course, and then we have another program called Nutrition Educator, which is to offer an alternative to dietetics. And then you and I are working on a program that will teach mental health professionals how to do drug-free therapy and how to withdraw people from psychiatric drugs. And we've got, what, 80 million people in this country taking them, so lots of people who need help. We have a program to teach people how to do musculoskeletal therapy without drugs and surgery. So anyway, that's how we started our school, with alternative training programs, and we'll qualify to convert to private college status in another 3 years, which is very exciting. And we think that this eventually will be training people in the healthcare field, you know, tens of thousands a year at some point. We're the only people who do this. And I'm like you. We need competition. Not only do I welcome it, we need it. But right now, the key is for us to continue to be successful at it so that other people will be encouraged to do the same thing.
It all sounds really, really wonderful. And talk more about your program of going into health delivery services and helping them take new approaches.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we've done in the past is we've recognized that still today, even with all the disruption in healthcare, large companies provide health coverage for their employees, and it's probably the leading cause of financial disruption within companies right now. The costs are just out of control, and it's been going this direction in a really long time. And it's not a secret that the typical health improvement program that's offered at a corporation doesn't really work. And I'm talking about these wellness programs. I won't mention names, but you can read the RAND Corporation report. They just decimated all of these companies. And this is the type of results we're talking about. I mean, companies are spending millions, tens of millions of dollars on this stuff. And, you know, at the end of the day, the person loses an average of 1 pound a year. Cholesterol drops 5 points. The average time for smoking cessation is 90 days. And so this is a failure rate that's just astounding. And the reason is that the programs they're using don't work. You know, it's a lot of busyness, but not really getting anything done. So we started doing intervention programs for employers about 10 years ago. We've published our data on a couple of them. We've done very well, and we've targeted in the past principally chronic degenerative conditions like coronary artery disease and diabetes, which respond really well to dietary change. I mean, with a great deal of predictability, most type 2 diabetics can reduce or eliminate their medication in a matter of a few weeks, which is pretty incredible when you look at the cost of taking care of a diabetic. And so we're expanding our marketplace now to offer interventions for mental health. That's what you and I are working on. And to offer interventions that address musculoskeletal injuries, which combined are actually a bigger hit financially than chronic degenerative conditions. So, and I think that's an area that really needs fixing, because companies will have no choice but to turn their employees in, you know, loose in the marketplace to buy insurance if they can't get costs under control. And there's nobody really doing much that gets costs under control right now. So that's a market we're going to be aggressively pursuing in 2017 with a three-pronged approach: chronic degenerative, psychological, and musculoskeletal health-related issues.
Well, it just all sounds very, very good. And folks out there, I've been very impressed with Pam Popper's scientific approach to these issues. Pam is really different than those people who are going to get in there and tell you you can tune up your dopamine and live happily ever after. She actually grounds herself in the scientific literature, which most physicians know nothing about. dealing with nutritional approaches. And she's a very serious scientist in her approach to these issues. And she's not one of these fad diet people either. She's got a sound approach to eating good food in a reasonable way. And I really admire that about you, Pam, that you haven't taken the easy route where a lot of people are making a lot of money, with one or another somewhat outlandish approach to nutrition. You've really avoided that and are working from sound principles. And I really admire that a lot.
It's important to do. You know, when you talk about the evidence, and I'll get rid of a myth that I think a lot of people carry. When you talk about practicing evidence-based health care, first of all, our colleagues don't know what that means. And in one of our promotional pieces that talks about what we do, I did some research on where do doctors get their information in general. Okay, so the leading source of information for doctors outside of the drug company reps is Wikipedia. I'm not kidding.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and when they're not reading Wikipedia online. Now, just to put that in perspective, if an undergraduate student in our school turns in a research paper to me listing Wikipedia as a reference, I will hand it back and say, I don't think you read the instructions and you'll need to change what you're doing if you expect to pass this course. When they're not looking at Wikipedia, their second favorite source of information is watching YouTube videos put out by drug companies, and it goes downhill from there. And so this is a major problem.
Is there a study that I could cite for that information,
yeah,
or is it in different places?
No, I'll get it for you.
Zip it over to me. It'll go into my new book.
Yeah, it's a frightening statistic. And so, and I wasn't taught to look at the evidence. In fact, I went to what a lot of people think is a better, I put air quotes around that training, naturopathic healthcare. And in order for me to be effective, I call myself a recovering naturopath. I've had to leave that behind too, because it wasn't any better in terms of evidence to base than the way traditional doctors approach things like cardiology and endocrinology. The difference was, we're going to use less toxic stuff. So you go to a doctor who wants to put you on a statin drug and you don't want to take it, so you go see a naturopath, he puts you on high-dose niacin, and somehow that's supposed to be better. It may not hurt you as much as the statin, but you still have high cholesterol. Your risk factors for heart disease and deaths by heart attacks and strokes, still the same, essentially. I mean, 1.2% reduction in your risk isn't really much to talk about. And so I'll never forget when I had this big aha moment shortly after I got out of school, that really what I learned in naturopathy school was how to hurt people less. And I don't think that's the goal of healthcare. I mean, seriously, what should I do? Put out a sign and say, you should come consult with me about your health. I'm not going to hurt you as much as those people down the street. And that was the beginning of really leaving my training behind and becoming a scientist and saying, look, I'm not going to be married to any idea or school of thought or practice specialty or whatever. I'm going to be married to the idea that evidence will drive decisions, and if evidence doesn't support it, it doesn't matter what it is, and it doesn't matter the initials after the name of the person who is suggesting it. It's a bad idea. And so what's happened is that I have become known for adhering to the science. It's one of the reasons I've gotten a lot of the attention I've gotten from films and publishers and that sort of thing. But I've alienated not only the traditional healthcare practitioners, but the alternative healthcare practitioners dislike me just as much because I call them out in the same way. Because again, it doesn't matter where you got your training. If what you do is not supported by evidence, I will call you out on it. And not by name, and I'm not trying to make problems with people. It's just that, a good example is the prescribing of omega-3 fatty acid supplements for everything from reducing cardiovascular risk factors to improving mental health, and 100% of all meta-analyses ever done have shown that the pills are useless for all of that, and people still prescribe it, and I'm going to continue to talk about it, and I really don't care who I make angry in the process. So anyhow, we, as a company here, we have 19 criteria for evaluating research studies to see if they're valid, and that's the filter we use, and it's quite objective. And when people come in here and complain, I tell them, well, why don't we pull out our 19 criteria sheet here? You tell me which one you would like to you would like to ignore in order to make your point. I mean, we could ignore the financial conflicts of interest, and you look pretty good, actually. Would you like for me to do that? In my next video clip, I'd be happy to highlight the fact that we've made that concession to you so you can look better. And they usually prefer we don't talk about it at all. So anyway, it's an unfortunate thing, but it goes back to why I think this whole revolution to change healthcare has to come from consumers, because when the consumer knows the truth and knows how to discern this stuff, the consumer will say no more and more and more. And the market will shift because of consumer demand, both away from things that don't work, whatever they are, whether it's omega-3 fatty acids or statin drugs. It will move away from that and toward other things like building and maintaining your health on your own.
Well said. I'm with you 100%. If you're comfortable with it, talk a little bit more about the statins, because I was shocked years ago to learn that the promotion of these statins was about as fake as the promotion of psychiatric drugs. Now, I actually took a statin, was prescribed a statin very early on. My family my dad had such a high cholesterol before anybody talked about cholesterol that he was being treated for it. And I got very sick on the statins. I got achy all over. My muscles hurt. I developed some sort of weird chronic illness. And I literally, in those early days, this wasn't instantly recognized. I was shifted around. And it was finally an infectious disease specialist who said, "This, I think this is a statin reaction."
Mm-hmm.
And then Tom Moore, you know Tom, he wrote a book on, he's a great researcher, he's been on my show, folks, you can look him up, Tom Moore. He did a book on the statins, and two of the things that he found were these percentages of improved rates were so tiny that you had to present them in peculiar fashions to make them look like they mattered. And the other thing he found out was that they were stacked with patients who had cholesterols of 500.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you didn't use them, there was no effect, no positive effect.
Right.
Do you have more to add to that about this? Because I think so important that so many folks are on statins. They have potentially psychiatric effects. They have physical effects.
Well, and they don't solve the problem. You know, the first thing is that in our country, we're one of two countries on the planet that allow the advertising of drugs on television and magazines, and this is a practice that has to stop. And one of the reasons is because if you watch these ads, I never thought about this before until one night I had this epiphany, it makes it look like it's fun to be sick, you know. You almost want to start taking Crestor so you can join the party out there and look at them on the roller coaster, right? You know, so that's a terrible thing, and it drives consumer demand for these drugs, and it makes them think that they're magical substances. But with statin drugs, you mentioned something very important, which is that people who have extraordinarily high cholesterol, familial hypercholesterolemia, for example, they may benefit a little bit from taking the drugs. But there's no money in prescribing drugs to the small audience of people who actually benefit. The money is in convincing everybody that they need them. And so the smaller the abnormality, the less likely a person is going to be benefiting from taking a drug. And so what's happened is we're medicating about 25% of the American population with statins. And if you aggregate the actual risk reduction and you report it in absolute rather than relative terms, which for anybody who doesn't understand statistics who's listening to this, drug companies and even the supplement makers do this a lot too. They'll report the relative drop in events, like the difference between 2% and 1%. You can say it's 50% or it's 1%, right? Well, if you say 50%, it sounds better. So they report it in relative terms instead of absolute terms. But if you look at the absolute risk reduction in the aggregate, it's 0.7% reduction in the risk of stroke or heart attack. And then you have all these side effects that you mentioned earlier, which are significant. And, of course, this goes to the informed medical decision-making thing that I talk about all the time and that we do here. A consumer should be told that. You know, the physician should say, your cholesterol is high. I can put you on a statin drug. Here is the 23 pages of side effects. The risk reduction is 0.7%. or I can show you how to eat your way out of it. No negative side effects from eating more salads and apples, you know. And you could eat your way out of it this way. It's a lot of people would say, I think I'll go for the salads and apples before I'm going to take this drug with this miserable track record. So anyway, the statin drug business is a big business. We're talking billions of dollars in sales of these drugs in this country, and probably 95% of the people taking them will not benefit, cannot benefit from them. Another thing that's happened in the cardiology business in particular is that we're medicating to lower and lower levels. And the more we medicate, the worse the side effects get. And this is going on right now, particularly in the hypertension business. And this is a business, by the way. I always talk about it like a business because people think healthcare, oh, caring people in white coats. Well, you and I are caring people, not in white coats, but we care. But that's not what's going on in a lot of these institutions. So in the cardiology business, a good example of just insanity is everybody got all excited last year about this SPRINT trial. We're going to try to medicate everybody's systolic pressure down to 120 or lower. In some of these patients, it took 4 drugs to get their systolic pressure down that low. And out of 1,000 people, 16 people were helped, and 22 people got hurt, and the other 960-something, I don't know what happened to them because this trial didn't go on long enough. In what universe does this sound like a good idea? So another group, I just read this morning.
Let me add that once you start doing that, your risk of, especially in the older folks, of falling and breaking your hip or something else that hitting your head. I mean, that because the low blood pressures, the diastolic start getting lower and lower, too. That's the second number.
That's what I was just going to say. And there's a new study just came out from Johns Hopkins. I read it this morning. I wrote an article on it. I'm filming a video clip on it next week. So a group at Johns Hopkins said, you know, the SPRINT trial, they're lowering systolic pressure so low, they have to be lowering diastolic pressure, too, which they are. So they started combing through all these cardiology trials looking at the outcomes. There are a few that have gone on for a couple, 3 decades. And they found a study, had 11,000 and some patients, followed for 21 years on average. And what they found is that when you medicate somebody so that their diastolic blood pressure goes under 60, they have a 220% increase in the risk of heart attack or dying from a cardiovascular-related event, as opposed to people who keep their diastolic pressure someplace around 80. And so we're hurting people. It's a J curve. You know, you medicate people aggressively and you reach a point where you're hurting more than you're helping. And again, a lot of these people shouldn't even be medicated. I mean, if you live in the UK, they don't medicate you for blood pressure, hypertension, until your pressure reaches 160 over 100 and it doesn't respond to diet and lifestyle change. Here, we come up with all these have you noticed this, pre-diabetes, pre-hypertension, pre-osteoporosis. That's so that we can medicate people earlier and earlier, more and more aggressively. And again, the smaller the abnormality, the less likely there will be benefit, and the more likely you'll get all harm. And so, and we could go from practice specialty to practice specialty. We can do it with endocrinology. We can do it with obstetrics and gynecology. We can do it with oncology. We can do it with everything. And you see the same pattern of behavior: overdiagnosis, overtreatment, not following the evidence, not telling the truth to the patients. And this business of not telling the truth to the patients, I have a big problem with this. I just read a study a few weeks ago, did a video clip on this. This study was very interesting. Researchers interviewed patients with lung cancer and their oncologists. And the purpose of the study was to see if the patient and the doctor had the same expectation about outcomes. And in almost 100% of the situations, the doctor-patient pairs where the interviews were done, the patient reported the reason for the treatment was to recover from cancer. And the doctor reported almost 100% of the time that the patient would most certainly die within a year. Now, how's that for a disconnect?
Wow.
Yeah,
reminds me of the surgeons. You hardly ever see anybody who's had a hip replacement or a knee replacement who says, and it hurt much less than the doctor said.
Right.
I mean, it's usually, and hysterectomies and things like that, it's usually, God, I had no idea it was going to hurt for this long.
Well, and you hear all the time, and this is what I hear in this office every day, if I'd known then what I know now, I never would have. And going back to our cancer patients with lung cancer, some research that was done by Gilbert Welch, who's written a lot of great books on medical decision-making, have shown that the vast majority of patients who get treatment for lung cancer, because as you know, treatment for lung cancer doesn't result in recovery. They almost all die. And once patients know that, they almost universally say, if I had known that was the case, I wouldn't have done the treatment. I would have just enjoyed my remaining days. Mm-hmm. So this issue that you find out after, I mean, think about what would happen in this country if we sold cars this way. The cars were largely defective. People got killed in accidents due to defective cars all the time. You never knew until after you bought the car that you were riding in something that was so dangerous. And then things happen every day, people getting killed in car accidents because of defective cars, and nobody does anything about it. And it keeps going on and on. And the dealers who sell these defective cars, they get richer and richer. And we just say, well, that's just the way it is. I mean, we wouldn't tolerate it in any other field, and we have got to convince consumers not to tolerate it in the healthcare field. And I sound like I'm on my soapbox, and I do spend a lot of time on my soapbox because we have to get this message out.
It's a scientific soapbox. Where does the FDA enter into this from your viewpoint? The folks know that I think the FDA is a toothless watchdog that's actually become a lapdog.
Yeah, well, you know how that happened. Our good friend Al Gore, one of his signature pieces of legislation was the PDUFA Act, prescription drug something or other. And here's how this all happened and what it means today. Okay, so the drug companies were complaining. They're always complaining about something, and Congress usually fixes it for them. They were complaining that it took so long to get drugs approved. And, of course, they always do a good job through patient advocacy organizations, which they fund, by the way. All those patients who are showing up in Washington to testify, they don't know that they're pawns of the drug companies, but they are. So they show up in Washington, and they make everybody feel like, oh, my gosh, the drugs are taking so long to get approved, so we need a shortcut for this. And so Congress passed a law that basically has resulted in the drug companies paying for three-fifths of the FDA's budget, three-fifths. Though, so far this year, this is a number that will just blow you away, the FDA has received $781 million from drug companies, which means that most of the people working in that big building in Washington, D.C. would not have jobs if the drug companies did not continue to put up this money. So as a result, 94% of all drugs that are submitted for approval are approved, and 99% of devices. And I've said this, and I've written about it. One of these days, and it won't be too long from now, the drug companies will just send a memo to the FDA saying, heads up, we're going to be introducing a new drug next month. There's going to be a lot of side effects. We'll probably kill a few people. We know you're going to hear about it, so we thought we should at least let you know. Have a great day. I mean, how can – they're just not even paying attention. They are financed by – they are an extension of the drug companies. And the sad part about it is – most doctors don't know this. And you know what else makes me just crazy is when doctors say things like, well, I don't have time to read about all of this. I mean, and I've had them even say to me when I've done, you know, book signings and that sort of thing, I really admire you for doing all this research. You know, if I had time, I would do that. I mean, think about if we don't tolerate this from anybody else. My accountant, I trust that he keeps up with the tax code. I wouldn't let him file my tax returns if he didn't. So people are going to doctors who do not keep up with the medical literature. They don't read. They believe what they're told, and they're very susceptible to any message that anybody wants to give them, including Wikipedia and the drug company reps. And so it all brings us back to the same place. We're not going to fix that. There's too much money in it. We can only fix it with consumers learning to just say no. And I've done this just for fun in places where I've been offered a lot of media attention. Let's all get together and practice as a group saying no. So what happens when your doctor says you should have this silly test? Well, all together now, what do we say? One, two, three, no. You know, because people are thinking they should not stand up to their doctors. It's disrespectful. He'll get mad at me. She'll get mad at me. I mean, where did that come from? Since when are doctors supposed to get angry about these kinds of things? So anyway, it's all about the consumer.
Oh, my psychiatric colleagues, they get rageful if you challenge them because they have such feet of sand. I want to go back to these figures you mentioned, and I want you to repeat them. The FDA has gotten how much money from the drug companies to support them?
$781 million so far this year. And I have to tell you something else, too. You know the Centers for Disease Control? The Centers for Disease Control, the Congress passed a law allowing a foundation to funnel money to the Centers for Disease Control from drug companies and other sponsors. And they've taken $620 million. And I spent
that
a Saturday
afternoon. Interesting.
Well, and I'll tell you what's really interesting is I took a Saturday afternoon one day just out of curiosity, and I started going through their tax returns, the foundation's tax returns, and looking at when drug companies had given the CDC Foundation money, and then the actions the CDC took on behalf of those companies, for example, the vaccine makers, flu vaccine makers, and this sort of thing. And they're very clever about the way they do it, because the money comes into the foundation, and then it sits there for a while till it's funneled to the CDC, and then they wait a respectable amount of time until they do something. So it's not like the money comes in today and there's an action tomorrow, which makes it tough to follow. It takes a long time to figure this out. But with a great deal of predictability, if money is coming into the foundation on a certain day, you can go 6-8 months later and pretty much almost guarantee that there will be an action on behalf of the agency that benefits that donor. I could find none. I could find
you
none.
You know, Ginger, and then I joined in with it, but Ginger found that there was a foundation doing the same thing at NIMH in the 90s when we were writing our book, The War Against Children of Color, and we exposed that foundation back then and wrote about it in the book, and we thought we'd shut it down. I'll bet that's back up in some form or another. It's very similar. The drug companies were giving money to a supposedly independent foundation who then funded researchers that were pets of the drug companies.
Exactly. And I'll tell you this, I'm not saying that I've looked at everything.
You know, it's all so corrupt.
But I spent a lot of time looking at this, and I couldn't find a single instance in which the CDC took an action that would be against any of the donors. And I looked for that. I did a lot of searching for that. Now, because that foundation has taken in so much money and the CDC's actions are very complicated, they're very good at obfuscating on their website. It takes a long time to figure things out, and they make contradictory statements one place versus another. And, you know, so that's why I have to sit down on a Saturday afternoon when there's nothing going on and figure this stuff out. But I couldn't find anything in the several hours I spent on it where the CDC took an action that would have upset any of these donors. So, and obviously, the money dries up. Tom Frieden, I loved his comment. Somebody, a reporter, asked him about this in an email. Don't you think this is a problem? And he comes out with this stupid comment about, we value our public-private relationships that allow us to do blah, 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 blah. I mean, I wish these people knew how foolish they sounded when they say this ridiculousness, because, you know, I mean, seriously, $620 million, and we value our public-private relationships. I mean, if people in the private sector did this, we'd all be in jail, you know? We would.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When years ago, when the New York Times still took letters from me, I wrote a letter pointing out that the American Psychiatric Association was taking tons of money from the drug companies. And the association got really upset and wrote back, and this was published too, saying that Dr. Bregan doesn't understand. We have a, quote, ethical partnership with the drug companies. The psychiatric association, medical director saying, and we have an ethical partnership with the drug companies.
Yeah.
It's an oxymoron.
You can't be a medical group
and have an ethical partnership with the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, I always love when they think that we don't understand. And here's the other thing that I hear all the time, because I talk about such a wide variety of issues. You know, the reason why I can't be right about the mammography issue is because I don't do breast cancer surgery. And the reason I can't be right about the overdrugging of hypothyroid patients is because I'm not an endocrinologist. And I keep saying, well, then show me where my statistical analysis is incorrect. Please, I've welcomed people to come. I've said, I'll make a YouTube video with you correcting me, you know, so that you can show me the error of my ways and we'll make it public, okay? So we can have this discussion in front of everybody, and they don't want to do that. But the bottom line is that it really doesn't matter what your practice specialty is. You can, if you are good at reading the medical literature and understanding what it says, whatever your practice specialty is, you can read any medical study and tell people what it says. So I love that you don't understand or you don't practice this particular thing, therefore your opinion is not valid. So anything but have the discussion about the data, right? They don't want to have discussion about the data.
That was thrown at me so much. You know, I'd never done a lobotomy, so I wasn't an expert. But I actually did manage to shut down most of the lobotomy programs. But my favorite one was, well, you've never had a suicide in your practice, doctor, so how can you be an expert on suicide? That's my favorite. Pam Popper, we've got a minute or two. Just brush up folks on the conference, where it is, how they find out about it.
Yeah, how wonderful it's going to be. It's in Columbus, Ohio, and which is the center of the universe. It's easy to drive here, and you go to wellnessforumhealth.com. The registration forms and everything are there. You can call our office at 614-841-7700. We're open 12 hours a day. People here to talk to you about it. The food will be fabulous. The celebration is going to be amazing. I'm very proud of us here. I'm proud of this group. I'm proud of what we've all done. So we are going to have a fun party, and I promise everybody who comes to this conference, including me, is going to learn new stuff. Our speakers are so incredible. They don't even know the stuff that they know. You know, I'm seriously, I've heard Colin Campbell speak 100 times. I've never listened to him and not learned something new. So, and I always learn something new from you. And you'll probably write another book on your way here because that's how prolific you are. By the time land in Columbus,
I'm going to work on my
manuscript.
I'm going to break a habit and actually work on my speeches. You can hear me twice on the Saturday talking about drugs and on the Sunday talking about helping people. It's going to be a wonderful conference. It's one of the few times when I am speaking at conferences in the next 6 months or so. This is the big opportunity to come and hear me as well, and to just get a whole new sense of what's going on in medicine that's really forward-looking in the United States and in the world today. I think it's just a tremendous opportunity. And just meeting Pam Popper is a wonderful experience. You can hear through the airwaves her energy, her enthusiasm, her intelligence, her creativity, her bravery. And it's all there at the conference. And I've been before, and I'm so glad to be invited back because I learn a lot. And I'm going to actually do something I rarely do, which is I'm going to see the whole conference from beginning to end. So, folks, join us, for goodness sakes. Oh, Pam, you know, we're going to hear the music starting soon, but do you want to say a word or two about your specialty? You're really into the gastroenterology stuff, right?
Yeah.
I want to say a word or two about that, what people can learn from your books and from coming
to
the conference.
Yeah, well, we started experimenting a few years ago with patients who had Crohn's and colitis, inflammatory bowel disease, and we managed to develop a protocol that fairly predictably puts people in remission in a short period of time. And so we've developed a reputation around that. That's how I met one of my friends who's speaking at the conference, Dr. Von Lanthan, actually. So we'll talk about that another time when we can spend more time.
And now we're going to end because the music is playing. Pam Popper, come hear us and visit our wonderful conference. Thank you, Pam.
Bye.